What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Editor Krissa Bell. Hey, Krissa, how's it going?
Hey, Dev, I'm good.
Thanks for joining us while Sherlyn is out. And also, podcast producer Ben Ellman is going to join us for this episode, too, to go down some news. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. This week, folks, Google is officially a monopoly, at least according to a U.S. judge, kind of confirming something a lot of people have been saying for a long time, monopoly when it comes to search, at least. So we're going to be diving into that, and also the silly case of X suing advertisers, and we could talk about the video the X CEO put up too, which is very much the succession scene where one of the, I think it was the assistants, Kyrie the assistants, tried to be a newscaster. Did not work out so well for her. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Also, be sure to stay tuned to the end of this episode for my chat with Mickey Down and Conrad K, the creators of HBO Max's show Industry. Season 3 of that show is premiering this weekend, and we had a really good chat about just how they're making it more ambitious and how they're also approaching the tech world. So be sure to listen at the end of this episode. Let's get right into it. And the biggest news this week is that Google is officially a monopolist. There was an antitrust case, antitrust lawsuit that the Department of Justice filed in 2020. And this is the outcome from all of that. There was a 10-week trial in 2023. Here's the quote. It's pretty killer. Google's a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. It has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And that's according to Judge Amit Mehta of the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia. Not Meta, the company. We'll be talking about them later. It always gets confusing. I was not too surprised by this ruling. I know this is this is big news because we have not seen an antitrust judgment go down against big tech since like Microsoft in the late 90s. But it also feels like we are in a very different federal regulatory environment. Krissa, what were your thoughts on this news?
I mean, it's not surprising, but it also is like a little surprising just because it's Google and it's felt like they're untouchable for so long. And a lot of the behavior that was kind of outlined as, you know, monopolistic and problematic is stuff that's been, you know, it's not like they uncovered some like new secrets that Google was doing, right? This stuff has all been out in the open for a long time. So in that sense, it was a little surprising to kind of, see them finally, have someone come after them for that. But yeah, I mean, this is, potentially could be a really big deal for them.
Could be a big deal. We don't know, like, there's no final judgment yet in terms of what, Amit Mehta says, Judge Mehta says will actually happen. But let's go down, like, a couple of things. The main thing is the lawsuit claimed that Google illegally acted to maintain its dominant position in search by paying Apple and Samsung and Mozilla billions of dollars a year to be the default search engine on their browsers and phones and all their other devices. I'm reading from our Engadget article here, by the way. And the Department of Justice also argued that Google facilitates almost 90% of web searches, and that by paying to be the default option, it prevented rivals from achieving the kind of scale it needed to compete. So that's the main thing here. What's interesting is that Judge Mehta also says that, you know, Google is producing a good product, like an excellent product and likely the best product on the market. But I think the argument is that by doing this, by paying billions of dollars, and there's some really interesting numbers here, Google essentially prevented any other sort of competition from coming about. And I don't know, I guess it's a thing you can just say, but it's also not like there are any really close competitors too. I know Microsoft is happy about this. Satya Nadella was out there talking about like Google's monopoly. And this like puts Bing in a better framing. But also, have you guys used Bing before the ChatGPT stuff? Like, just use Bing as a search engine. It was awful. Like, pretty much every other search engine I've tried DuckDuckGo. That's not too bad. There are a couple others. But there aren't really any good alternatives to Google, too. So I feel like we're in a really weird place, how you describe this as a monopoly. The Wall Street Journal, of course, came out with an op-ed that was like, what monopoly? Because Google's not harming consumers, right? They're calling Google a very strange monopolist because it violates antitrust law, even though it doesn't harm consumers. I guess that's the real argument. Any thoughts around that, like, argument, Krissa?
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument that Google's making. You mentioned Apple before. I don't know if you saw, there was a quote that came out in the court documents that was reported. I think it was from Eddie Q, who said he wouldn't use Bing as the default search on iOS if it was free. Which was like, so for Microsoft, I feel like it's kind of like win some, lose some. But yeah, I mean, it's also, there's also part of it, you know, it wasn't just about the default search engines. There's also, you know, their advertising business was also part of this case as well, that they were artificially inflating prices on their own ads. And I think, you know, you probably have a clear argument there that like that was harming, if not consumers, like people that they do business with.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely. And this gets confusing too, because there's a separate suit against Google's overall digital ad business. In this judgment, they're referring specifically to search ads, so the stuff around search results. It is certainly, yeah, it is certainly very convenient that Google can just milk money from this thing. You know, that is essentially how it pays for the search and everything. But yeah, Google is basically always helping itself by essentially paying competitors to use its search engine. Then it makes its own money from those ads. There were numbers being thrown around a couple of years ago. Google reportedly paid around $20 billion to Apple in 2021. It was $18 billion then, but people are assuming like around $20 billion now.
And that made up a significant percentage of Apple's total revenue, right?
It did. It did. Like, I mean, Apple's a
huge
company.
That's crazy.
It is crazy that the amount Google can just throw out there. Google also confirmed, so this number was confirmed, that it pays Apple 36% of search ad revenues. Now, it's unclear if that number is also a part of this like $20 billion-ish that it's paying to Apple, but you know, it pays these companies. It pays companies in a way to party, to team up with Google because they still make some of the ad money down too. The craziest number I saw, and Ben, you pointed this out, and I think like people were not aware of how entrenched Google was in basically in Mozilla's business. But Mozilla apparently, let me see here. According to Mozilla's 2021 and 2022 financial statements, $510 million out of Mozilla's $593 million revenue came from Google search result payments or search payments. That's a lot of money. That is the vast majority of Mozilla's revenue. And Mozilla's a nonprofit, so they're not like a company that's really gearing up to sell a lot of things. But that,
in fact, I want to read something from Mozilla's like financial statements. It said that approximately 81 and 83% of Mozilla's revenues from customers and contracts were derived from one customer for the years ended December 31, 2022 and 2021. And so they're not talking specifically about Google, but Google is that one customer. That's ridiculous.
So it's just, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about with this case when you think about these numbers and what a big piece of their business this Google revenue is. That one potential outcome of this case is the judge could say, well, you can no longer pay to be the default. And then like that would actually probably hurt companies like Apple and Mozilla the most, because then they would lose that revenue, but then people would still probably choose to use Google. So like Google would still get the ad money anyway. So it's kind of a,
and not have to share it with those companies. I think Google has constructed this just like perfect situation where it will really hurt a lot of these companies. Mozilla in particular, like I remember when I was working in IT, it was always, hey, everybody, just use Firefox, right? Firefox is the thing to use. Then Chrome came out when around like 2005-ish, and that started, it was smaller, it was nimbler, it was faster. Firefox just stopped really innovating as much. I honestly have not seen like a major Firefox release or launch or anything like super innovative in the last decade. And I almost wonder, like, if you're being paid such a huge chunk of money from your main browser rival, why would you innovate? Why would you try to get better? Like, it just, that is such a messy conflict of interest.
It's kind of a way of owning a company without owning the company.
I mean, and Mozilla, not a for-profit organization. I love Mozilla as a company typically. I have friends who work at Mozilla. Like, it is like the philosophy of Mozilla of open source software and, you know, trying to produce great products without nickel and diming people for it. Or they're also big into privacy now. So that's a good reason to use Firefox compared to everything else. Right, Carissa?
Yeah, that's one of their biggest selling points, I think, for people who choose to use Mozilla over Chrome is, you know, a lot of people, it's for privacy reasons. They don't, you know, they don't track as much. They're not as intrusive with advertising. They don't have the same business model, obviously, since they're a nonprofit. And I think, and that's kind of like the thing that they always hammer is that, you know, we're, you know, we care about your privacy and the others don't.
Except we're being paid by the company that's collecting all of your data and also probably still collecting data through those Google searches on Firefox. Dude named Charlie in the chat is pointing out Brave. Yes, Brave, I hear, is a really good privacy focused one. What was the AI browser that was in the news recently?
Perplexity.
You're talking about. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about Arc.
No, I'm thinking of Arc. Perplexity was something else, right? Wasn't that that's the search engine, or that's, yeah, not the browser, but Arc was the one that has the weird founder, and then people got really turned off by that whole thing. But really does like bring, it just puts like the entire browser industry and the search industry in perspective here too, because you gotta team up with the browsers if you want to have a dominant search engine. But if you're paying everybody to do it, and if you're essentially paying one of your major browser competitors so much money, like, yeah, they don't have a reason to innovate. So many other browsers are basically based on Chromium now. Microsoft Edge, no longer based on Microsoft stuff. It's a Chromium browser. It can run Chrome extensions and things like that. Yeah, people are pointing out, aren't Firefox and Safari the only Chromium holdouts right now? And I think so. That's the thing. So Google has essentially also taken over the browser world in multiple ways. Even if you're not really running Chrome, you may be running Chromium, which is an open source project, but that they have all their hands in, or they're directly like just paying Mozilla, a nonprofit, so much money. Ben, do you have any other thoughts on this whole situation?
I'm wondering what exactly is actually illegal, because if you were to argue the other side, you could say that they're saying that it's just not fair that Google has so much money that they can pay
that they're
these
so
other
successful
companies.
Yeah.
I can see an argument where people would be like, oh, well, you know, just get good or something.
Yeah.
But the other problem is that if you are so big and you can pay so much money, then how is any other browser or any other search engine supposed to even get a foothold?
So Judge Mehta said that Google violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act, which was, I believe, the very first antitrust act from 1890. And the first text of that is just says, every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor. And blah, blah, blah. Then it talks about the punishments. Not exceeding $5,000 punishment. I think we're probably going to upgrade that a little at this point. for Google. But it's also, we've talked about Lina Khan and the way she has classified antitrust when it comes to like Amazon, right? Similar story there, where it's a company that is delivering consumers low prices typically. And under older definitions of monopoly and antitrust, Amazon technically isn't doing anything wrong, except they're doing it in new ways, and they're using data from competitors to resell products. They're crushing competitors in new ways. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to rethink the way we consider a monopoly at this point. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal is like, what monopoly? This is all great for consumers. It's the best search product, which it technically is, but could it be better? Because right now my Google search results are surrounded by awful ads and sponsored posts up top. So,
oh, yeah, no. Like yeah. The sponsored posts are the top five, six links now.
That's all money for Google. This is not the Google from the 2000s, the early 2000s, late 90s, where it's just like, just give me, just text, super fast search, just text. Yeah.
So another question that I have for Carissa is that I'm surprised that we only brought up Lina Khan like 15 minutes into talking about this or so. How did this get through the courts, and was this something that was spearheaded by Lina Khan, or like what was its path?
I see Tom Rogers in the chat puts it pretty succinctly. It's the non-competitive activities that violate antitrust. Being big is not a violation, but using your size to limit competition and cornering entire sector is the violation. That is more clearly related to the actual antitrust law.
Yeah. I think that's a much smarter point of view. And that's something that kind of the very pro-business people, like, oh, why are you punishing people for being successful, wouldn't really understand, or definitely would not argue from that point of view.
But I think Lina Khan is trying to remake the rules for antitrust. You know, she's been going after so many companies, you know, and that's why they've all been lobbying against her. And it's interesting, like, they're all kind of making the same argument, like, you're punishing us for being good. you're punishing us for being successful and like owning the markets. But I think like what we'll probably see by the end of her tenure is that she, you know, she is remaking these rules, and you know, some of these companies could have look very different by the time she, by the time all these cases are done.
Mm-hmm. I think, but I believe Lina Khan's term is up. Is it later this year or next year? It's very soon, so she's not going to be, you know, leading the FTC for too long. But looking at like what she's accomplished, even if it wasn't entirely successful against a lot of these companies, I do think like overall, like the government is kind of like taking a closer look at startups right now. There are several against Meta. There are several against all the big companies. Microsoft, in an earlier stage, took a lot of heat for basically, I don't know if people remember this, but it was because Internet Explorer was included within Windows, and that was a major problem because then it was the default and nobody else could really compete with that. Microsoft took a lot of flack for that, paid, took a while, paid a lot of fines. Eventually, the solution was, hey, let's have a browser pop-up when I think when you launch Windows to choose what you want to be your default browser. I think they found ways kind of around that right now too, which is kind of funny because you still have, you don't get default sent to Bing when you install Windows. But if you go try to install like Chrome or something or another browser while you're in Edge, Edge will tell you, hey, you're running a pretty fast browser right now that runs a lot of things Chrome does. Why are you going over to Chrome? You don't need to download this other browser. So yeah, no. Microsoft is still doing its thing. I feel like all these companies just want to push the limits until they're punished, right?
I mean, in the end, did it really, how much did that ruling hurt Microsoft in the 90s? I mean, it set them back a little bit, but I mean, look at Microsoft now. Like, I don't think anyone there is pointing to that ruling and saying, oh, well, you know, if only we hadn't had that happen.
That was the moment that computers as a concept started going bad.
It was all over since then. I mean, I think that was maybe a big stumbling block against Internet Explorer, because it probably forced them to like try to be better and try to compete on its own merits. But that was a freaking useless browser for so long. Like when I worked in IT, Internet Explorer was just the thing that brought all the bad stuff to Windows XP and everything else, then Windows Vista and everything. And I used to write like the tips for incoming students, like, don't use Internet Explorer, use Firefox, use other browsers, be careful about what you download. I once got a call from a student who was like, hello, my computer, my mouse is moving on its own and it's typing to me and somebody's typing messages to me.
Oh, and that's scary.
It was a full takeover of their computer. I had to be like, unplug your computer from the internet. Step one, unplug. But we were in a state where computers were so easily hacked and so vulnerable because of Internet Explorer and because of Microsoft's own issues. So I don't know. That's a bit of a flashback, I guess, for Google. What is, we don't have a sense of like what Judge Mehta says is going to happen or will be, you know, will be the result of this. But I almost imagine like Apple and others may just want to have something similar. Like, hey, when you launch this for the first time, choose your default search engine. That's entirely up to you. We're going to be hands off on that. I feel like that's where it may go.
Yeah. I mean, that's like one really like, I think easy to see scenario. There's also, you know, there's scenarios where like maybe they could be forced to, you know, sell parts of their business. I know that's been speculated about. You know, there's probably going to be big fines involved. But, you know, they're also still probably going to appeal whatever it is in the end as well. So who knows what they're going to actually have to do in the end. You know, this could still play out over several more months.
The Microsoft antitrust judgment took like over a decade, I believe, of back and forth and everything. Like I wrote about that when I started writing about tech. It was like 2010. I was writing about some rulings through Europe and through the US government. And just hilarious. Just funny to see how quickly justice moves. Okay. So we're going to keep an eye on the story. Google's officially monopoly and they don't feel very good about it. Something else in your wheelhouse, Krissa. In other news, we saw the news that X is suing advertisers for, quote, illegal boycott of the platform. This is hilarious. It also came with a new Linda Yaccarino video where she was very, very adamant about, like, how unjust it was that these advertisers did this and, like, were colluding against Twitter. Can you break this the story down for us?
Yeah, so Linda Yaccarino posted what I can only describe as, like, a hostage video. You know, where she's like,
yeah,
alone in a room.
There's something trained at her. Yeah.
And she's, you know, she's saying how she's so shocked to have found out that all of these advertisers had colluded to boycott X and, you know, hurt their users and deny, you know, by denying their business ad revenue that was somehow like really, you know, it's really for the users. So they're filing an antitrust lawsuit, interestingly, in the state of Texas, not any of the states where they currently do business.
They may be moving their headquarters there, right? That was the story.
Well, I mean,
yeah. Musk, who knows?
Musk said that, but
they
haven't made any moves that I know.
Well, they definitely are closing the like downtown San Francisco office. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're suing the World Federation of Advertisers and then like a subset of that group called GRAM. I forget what that acronym stands for at the moment, but they're basically like a coalition of big digital advertisers that, you know, set kind of brand safety guidelines for the industry.
And that is specifically GARM, the Global Alliance for Responsible Media.
Yes.
What an acronym and what a name.
Yes. And this includes like CVS Health, Mars, Unilever, so like, you know, pretty big names in the digital ad world. And, you know, this lawsuit basically is saying that they conspire to, you know, carry out this boycott against, you know, this advertising boycott against X, which is very hilarious argument, actually.
Yeah, because what happened was essentially advertisers left because Elon Musk bought the site and was a toxic piece of crap for a very long time. Like that's you've covered things like the whole like, oh, we saw a lot more racist and anti-Semitic videos and or posts on X, and there was no more content moderation, right?
Yeah, I mean, he got rid of the content moderators. There's all these groups that came out. There are, you know, tons of research, tons of examples of really, you know, hateful, toxic stuff. A lot of times that was appearing alongside advertising. And X has spent the last 2 years trying desperately to convince advertisers that, you know, they're fixing it. They're really the most brand safe platform out there. They've gone above and beyond all the requirements. And like, you know, don't you really want to do business with them? But, you know, on the other hand, the other thing that they didn't mention is that, you know, by all accounts, we don't have a lot of visibility into this now that they're not a public company, but by all metrics, it appears that, you know, a lot of people have left their platform. Their user base has actually shrank, which, you know, could also be a reason why, you know, perhaps some advertisers would want to leave, you know, besides, you know, the way its current associations. But yeah, they're basically saying like, we're going to, you know, you guys aren't paying us anymore. And so we're mad and we're going to sue you for antitrust.
I thought these folks believed in the free market and for folks to decide where they put their money, you know, not out of any
wokeness. The crazy thing about this is that Musk and Iaccarino right now are saying, oh, we're very mad at GARM for like maybe colluding to like not advertise on us, when the entire idea of GARM is brand safety. The idea that you don't want your Pepsi or like Nestle ad right next to like based Kekistan, you know, talking about how you know, they need an ethno state or something.
Or Elon Musk supporting white nationalists, basically.
Literally. Yeah. Like, they just want to make sure that the places that they advertise on are going to be brand safe, and you're not going to be able to get really easy screenshots of a Pepsi ad or a Coke ad right next to something really, really, really that you don't want associated with your company. And that's all X is right now.
It is, you know, I tried to step away, folks. I tried the Mastodon, I tried Blue Sky. I still hang out at those places occasionally, but what I realized, all my friends are still on Twitter. Like, everybody I talk to, like all the people I typically follow, and I'm not going to let some billionaire just get in there and like ruin my neighborhood, right? Like, he's literally the villain in the 80s movie who's trying to, destroy the rec center, you know? That's basically what it is. And we're like, no, we live here. We're not going to let this stand.
Okay, but the actual, like, analogy is that you are living, or you're choosing to continue to live in a neighborhood that is rapidly dilapidating.
Oh, absolutely.
You're living
I'm used to that,
like,
buddy.
Okay, but you're living in, like, I don't know, Detroit in the 90s or something. Things are getting actively worse, and you are just hoping that eventually something will change.
We hope eventually something will change. And also, it helps to be there to see what the hell is happening, because, hey, these free speech warriors, Elon Musk and his crew, so the free speech is so hard on Twitter right now. If you write the word cisgender, you will get flagged for potentially violating conduct, which is the funniest meme I've seen right now, too. I'm sure you've seen this, Krista, where Elon Musk says something about free speech and like what a great free speech platform is. And the first reply with all the likes is somebody just saying cisgender, and the auto-populated site warning, content warning pops up. Guess that's not, can't have free speech around that. Similarly.
I mean, yeah. Okay, let me contradict myself. And, you know, I was previously saying that X is not really relevant so much anymore. Mm-hmm. I still think that's kind of true. On the other hand, it did have a really significant hand in the riots that happened in England last weekend.
In a good way or bad way? Just in terms of disseminating the information?
Oh, yeah, no. Disseminating information about a knife crime that killed a couple of kids, and then they said that it was tied to a mosque, and it was not actually tied to that mosque. And so there are a bunch of...
And doxed the wrong person.
Doxed the wrong person.
Listen, so a bunch of bigoted people just like... stormed this mosque thinking that they were going to be doing something good, but no, it was really just using X as a way to direct some like racist energy.
It sucks. Like, yeah, basically a whole weekend of mob activity in the UK, just awful to see. I will also say, on the flip side, like, social media, like any tool, can be used for good or evil. We were talking about JD Vance and couches entirely because of one person's shitpost. One person's shitpost changed the world. Basically.
Wouldn't be the first time.
It would not be the first time, but it wasn't even like a video. It wasn't even like, it was just a normal sized tweet.
That Twitter magic is still there.
That Twitter magic is still there. Great trolling. The power of trolling can be used for good. And now you have, the new vice presidential candidate making couch jokes about JD Vance. So, you know, the internet, still influential.
What happens from here? Carissa, what do you think?
So it's an interesting question. I think if they had sued anywhere else, we could probably say that, you know, they don't have much of a chance with this, let's say, legal theory. But this is not the first time that, you know, Elon Musk and X have sued an organization that they didn't like, that they thought was associated with this boycott. They sued two other groups, the Center for Countering Digital Hate and Media Matters, which were both had done research showing that, you know, there was hate speech on the platform.
Media Matters had a couple great articles about that. Yeah.
Yes, and the lawsuit against CCDH got dismissed. The lawsuit against Media Matters is before a judge in Texas, the same judge that looks like got this case. And he has not dismissed it. He's actually done some kind of unusual things, according to, you know, some of the legal people I've seen talk about this case. They've granted a ton of discovery before Media Matters have actually been able to argue for a dismissal, which has been super costly for them. They've run up huge legal fees. They had to do layoffs. So, you know, that lawsuit is now really affecting that organization in a bad way, even though, you know, it's probably, and there's a judge that is going along with that. If in Texas, who knows, you know, ideologically, if they're aligned with Musk or not, it seems like they're at least, you know, a lot more willing to entertain these theories than perhaps other judges. So the fact that this case looks like it's getting the same judge is, we might actually see more come of this than we would think, just based on how ridiculous it seems. You know, that's kind of the weird thing with Musk is, like, somehow he can still get these little victories that you wouldn't expect, just because, you know, they can throw so much money and influence at these things.
It's totally sad. There are so many examples of free speech being chilled on Twitter right now. A friend of mine just got a, maybe because of posts they were retweeting or things they were tweeting, got a little post saying your account has been flagged for potentially spam activity or nefarious activity. Just a normal poster. Nothing unusual, not even a major poster. What were you going to say, Ben?
Oh, just that I don't see how this lawsuit could go so poorly for Garm, because Garm has a pretty good way of saying, like, our entire idea is making sure that everything is brand safe, and you can see from these many, many screenshots that there's lots of stuff that is not brand safe on this website. On top of the lower user activity, on top of the fact that the site isn't growing anymore, like, you can put it in the most kangaroo court in the country if you want, but I still don't think that there's going to be a really surprising outcome.
Yep.
No.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, and this time he's not going up against a small nonprofit. You know, this time he's trying to bully some of the biggest advertisers in the world, you know, who presumably have very highly paid legal teams. So,
oh yeah, this will probably be fun to watch. I just want to see Unilever, like, throw some soap at him or something. Just, like, yeah, just attack him completely. Well, you know what, Krista, thank you so much for joining us to chat about this stuff. I'm sure you'll be following the X and Twitter story and probably the Google Monopoly stuff too. Where can we find your work online these days?
You can find me hanging out mostly on Threads these days. I am still on X, mostly lurking, not tweeting much these days. And obviously,
how are you liking Threads? Because every time I go there, I'm just like, man, you're still so thirsty. You're showing people at me that you want to, like, make viral. Like, it seems like it's going so hard.
You know, I'm coming around to it. I'm spending a lot of time there. The algorithm is still surfaces some questionable stuff sometimes, you know, but the engagement is a lot better. Like, people interact. It's weird because I have far, far fewer followers than I ever had on X, but I get, you know, people actually, it feels like your content actually gets, your posts get in front of people, they interact with you. It actually feels like a lively place with people, whereas I feel like X, you know, for the past few years, just kind of feels like you're just kind of shouting into the void most of the time.
Oh, yeah, because your posts are being weighted against people paying for X, too. So, like, if you're not a Twitter Blue subscriber, then, yeah, nobody will see you.
One more question, Carissa. You work in news. How often do you thread about news, especially given the fact that Meta has pretty much said, like, Threads is a good vibes-only place. Mm-hmm, like, please don't talk about, like, controversial news stuff.
Very often, I think. I try to share a lot of my own work on there. I definitely, you know, I've definitely been ignoring the kind of don't talk about politics or political content, or your stuff won't get surfaced by the algorithm. I mean, first of all, I think that's just kind of a ridiculous stance for a company that's trying to, like, build some version of the public square. And also, just based on what I've seen, like, their algorithm is not actually that good at separating what's, like, political content and what's not. So, you know, I kind of ignore that. I'm not somebody who's going to, like, jump in and talk about every kind of thing that's going on with the election or whatnot. But if there's, you know, a story that's related to politics that I'm working on, or, you know, even not that I'm interested in, like, I'm all about, like, getting out there and just putting my thoughts out.
You're kind of implying that you see good engagement from it.
I mean,
from those posts.
Yeah, it's certainly guarantee better than it, X.
Basically. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that settles it for me.
I think the algorithm in Threads does weigh towards, hey, people want to see stuff happening with their posts. They want to see likes. They want to see replies. So, like, they've tweaked it around that. Krista, you're doing a great job of sharing your work around. I see your stuff on LinkedIn, too. So, like, you're hardcore when you're sharing posts on LinkedIn.
I'm trying, you know. I'm like, I'll take all the engagement I can get, you know. And I'm like, well, and, you know, LinkedIn's kind of interesting because
it is.
Yeah. I, like, dismiss it, but, like, there's actually, like, a lot of people who are really into, like, LinkedIn and commenting, mm-hmm. and just that's kind of, like, a source of news for them, which I can't say is ever a way I've used it, but if that's what they want, I'm just going to give the people what they want.
The business influencer crowd is very much on LinkedIn, especially, like, big corporate people and honestly executives too, from what I've seen. So it's a thing. But all right. Thank you so much for joining us, Carissa. We'll chat again soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Carissa, for joining us. Let's move on to some other news. We got some actual gadgets this week too, not just policy stuff and advertisers. Google made a couple announcements. They announced the Google TV Streamer, which is their official replacement for the Chromecast line. It is a sliver of a device. Like, this is a really strange device. It's no longer a dongle like the previous Google TV device. It is almost kind of like pillbox shaped. It's a little bigger than the like round Google remote. It is also an Internet of Things device. It can also be like, I believe, a broadcaster for Matter devices, or like, what do you call that? A satellite for Matter devices. Has slightly better better hardware. The Chromecast with Google TV came out in 2020. This one has 22% faster CPU, double the RAM, 4 gigabytes instead of 2, and 4 times more storage. So that's 32 gigabytes of storage. That's useful for apps and things like that. Not so much. I don't think people are really downloading videos on this. You get your basic streaming stuff. You get 4K 60 FPS, HDR, Dolby Vision. It's a streaming device. You know, it has Ethernet in the back. It seems pretty straightforward. It is interesting, though, to see Google kind of go back to this rather than just like the cool little dongles that it's been leaning on for so long. Like, Ben, do you got any thoughts about that?
No, I'm just happy to see that Google is still doing a streamer, and it makes sense with the next thing that we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely. You know, the streamer, let me see here. It's interesting because, like, Google is trying so hard not to be a streaming company, but also the whole Google TV branding was a weird thing as well. Like, that was like 2010, 2011. They initially started that with some devices from Logitech and other companies. I tested one of those. They even installed a Dish Network satellite on my Brooklyn apartment to like test it out. And that was basically, you had a giant keyboard and an interface that combined satellite TV plus like occasional web access. It was not good. Now we're in a simple situation where people just want a simple remote for getting streaming content. Also, streaming video was like not nearly as big as it was back then. Mm-hmm. I do miss, I think I will miss the idea of the Chromecast, because that was cool. That thing was, what, $35? It was really cheap when it came out. It got better over time, but it was just like, hey, you don't need a giant Apple TV or a Roku box. Just stick this little thing in your HDMI jack and you've got a streaming device, or you can cast
to
it from your phone.
One could say that it kind of predicted like the Fire Stick, right?
Oh, kind of. I guess kind of. The Fire Stick is a full-on, like, hey, set-top box with an OS and everything. Before the Fire Stick, Roku did make sticks too. So it was Roku did it first. Yeah.
Okay.
But it was like, yeah, these devices got smaller. What was interesting about the Chromecast is that it was essentially just like a little server waiting for you to send information to it from your phone. And since that thing came out and it's been upgraded, devices just have casting. You know, your TV has casting.
Yeah, that's true.
Support.
That's true.
Video receivers have casting. So you don't really need the Chromecast as much, because if you have a modern piece of equipment, you'll probably be fine with it. But I still have to say, RIP Chromecast. Also, RIP still the Chromecast audio, which was a cool little thing. That was a cool way to just, I plugged that into some old speakers when that came out, and I could stream to those speakers and they still sounded great. Yeah, it's good stuff.
So it seems like this is really more of a smart home hub, mm-hmm. which is why I was talking about the next thing we're going to be talking about, which is the new Nest thermostat.
Yes.
But they're like, okay, well, if we're asking people to like connect us to their TV, then we better have some streaming on it too. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a hub with streaming rather than a streaming box with a hub.
I mean, that's kind of the way they work right now. The Apple TV is technically also a hub for AppleKit. It's not like a widely advertised thing, but I think what these companies are doing is essentially, you have this box, it's connected to the internet, it has antennas, and maybe we can use those antennas for more than just Wi-Fi, more than just to stream stuff to you. Like, this is a cool little box with a decent amount of smarts that can do Internet of Things controls, don't take much bandwidth. So I think they're kind of using it in that respect. Yeah, we also wrote about the new Nest Learning Thermostat, which has, it's basically all display now. The LCD display is 60% larger. What's cool is that the text kind of changes size depending on how far away you are from it. So that's kind of cool. It's using the, like, I think the Soli sensor, the Soli radar sensor to do that. Has some AI features. It'll also come with a sensor that you could put elsewhere in the room. But yeah, it also is a built-in sort of like a Matter hub, or it can all connect together. You know, I assume if you have the Nest thermostat, like, maybe you could do some cool stuff if you have the Google TV streamer. I don't know if anybody cares about this stuff, but it's cool.
Nest thermostat hadn't been updated in a long time.
In a long
correct?
Time, yeah.
So were you ever afraid that this could end up on the Google graveyard?
Oh, absolutely.
Because Yeah, Google is notorious for just like throwing out stuff that pretty much works, but I don't know, they get bored of it or they don't know how to like connect it with other stuff. But it seems like the Nest Hub was, not Nest Hub, excuse me, Nest Thermostat was always kind of just going to be shambling along, even if it hadn't gotten much of an update, because that's where a lot of Google's smart home like value lives. Other than that, what are you doing? Controlling lights?
You know, I remember when the Nest thermostat first came out, everyone was like, ooh, a thermostat with a screen. We've never seen that before. And once Google bought them, all the stories were like Nest just could not really survive under Google's management. Like as a company, as a sub-brand of Google, it was just kind of a mess. So that's why there has not been much of a, you know, much advancements there. Also, you don't replace your thermostats that much. So there's no real need to constantly have new ones. I have some of the real basic ass Nest thermostats. So not the Nest Learning thermostat. I have just the basic Nest one. And to me, that's fine. I've heard so many horror stories from people who have the learning thermostats, because that learning assumes a lot and often does controls where it's like, I really want my house to be warm. It's the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. I want my house to be warm by the time I get there. And you could set up a thing and the learning, because of the learning mechanisms of it, which you're not quite sure of, it may not be as warm as you want because Google decided better for you, which is also why like the AI features they're talking about here. I'm like, I don't know about that. I don't know if anybody is really going to, you want your thermostat just to do what you're telling it. You know, maybe a few tweaks here and there to be like, hey, maybe I could save you some bucks by not going so warm. But you also don't want to go overboard. You know, I feel like that's my main thing. Okay, moving on. We saw the story that Meta is reportedly offering Hollywood actors millions to use their voices in AI projects. Reportedly, Awkwafina, Judi Dench, and Keegan-Michael Key could be part of their new digital assistant, Meta AI. This is not the same Meta AI that we talked about. Was it last year where the chatbot platform with 28 characters voiced by celebrities?
Yeah.
The information reported that Meta just entirely gave up on that project. Like if you go back, look for references of that on Facebook or Instagram, they just never happened.
Okay, so how much money did they pay to, pulling up the article now, Kendall Jenner, Dwayne Wade,
millions.
Charli D'Amelio,
millions.
Tom Brady, Mr. Beast, like for their image rights, because all these people are lawyered, agented up enough to have image rights in their contracts and everything. And then they're just like, oh, you know what, we don't want to do this. People aren't interacting with it. I think you're going to see a lot more companies burning a lot more money in a similar way to try to get people to interact with AI in like any way that's actually fun for them.
Whatever it takes, however much money it takes, like this is Meta using its wealth to fund AI, just like Google used its wealth to fund its dominance in search. Like it is, everyone's desperate and they're doing whatever they can and throwing money wherever they can to kind of make this happen. So yeah, we don't know much about this yet. This is not an official thing. I believe Meta's Connect conference in September is when we're going to hear more about this. But I think the idea,
if they can figure out the deals. And I think the problem is that Meta is saying, hey, Screen Actors Guild, I know that you just went through this really difficult strike last year to figure out like AI stuff. But hey, would you like to figure out some AI stuff again?
Most definitely. I mean, we are still in the midst of the SAG-AFTRA video game actor strike too. And maybe some of those people, I'm sure they'd want to get some like notable video game actors or voices would want to be here too. The idea is to basically get these folks to say some lines and incorporate it right into whatever their next conversational AI general assistant is. I don't know, man. I don't know. We saw this stuff initially with Waze, you know, where Waze had celebrity voices just giving you directions. I understand that. I think it's really.
I did use the Snoop Dogg turn by turn directions for a while.
They were so fun. The problem was they didn't stick around, right? They were only licensed for a short time, so you can't have like your forever Waze voice. And also for this, if I was an actor, I'd be like, I don't know exactly what you're going to say with my voice. Like, can you really guarantee that you are going to have good guardrails so that my voice is not saying weird things because of your, because of your technology? I don't think they can. So,
and also, every actor has their own list of guardrails, probably, just because of their background or the types of projects that they tend to work on. You know, what if you had an actor well known for horror movies saying that horror movies are bad mm-hmm. or something?
I'm sure this is something the union, like SAG, will probably like lock into, like just to have a base level protections for everybody. I'm not excited about this. Speaking of Meta, speaking of tons of money being used towards AI slop, there was a great article from 404 Media, love those folks, by Jason Kebler, talking specifically about like a lot of the memed AI images come from. Apparently a lot of it's from places like India and Vietnam and the Philippines. AI spam that's used to generate engagement, basically. Ben, I know you were really into this story. Can you like lay this out for us?
Yeah. So right now, one of the windows I have open is the YouTube homepage. The first thing that I see on the YouTube homepage is some promoted video that says, "I just made arbitrage trading bot with ChatGPT," and like a guy with laser eyes and a little screen that shows like how much he has in Ethereum and how much money that is. It seems like a lot of the AI slop is coming from, like you said, Indian and Vietnamese YouTubers who are using this same logic as the, you know, finance gurus selling classes to show people how to make AI slop to put it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. They're getting so specific as to say, you know, Indian audiences like this. American audiences really like pets. So it would be great if you made a new Facebook page and then just posted a lot. And if you post a lot, eventually you'll be invited to the like get paid to post on Facebook program, even though there should be more guardrails for who gets paid to post on Facebook. And then once you're in the get paid to post on Facebook program, you can earn a lot of money in local currency because you're making money in USD. And so if you have one post of Shrimp Jesus that you generated with Bing Image Generator that goes massively, massively viral, and tons of Facebook people are saying amen to the picture of Shrimp Jesus, then you might make something like $200 American, which is way more than you would make monthly as someone doing a relatively low-wage job in India.
That also requires lots of hard labor, too. So I want to be clear, I'm not faulting anybody for like trying to get paid from Meta to do a lot of this dumb AI stuff. It is just funny to see like this is what these companies rely on, right? It's like when a lot of people are talking about their AI image matching or things like that. Like it turns out it's usually low wage workers in Africa or other like all over the world, but not the West. It's still people. It's still people powering this stuff. And these companies are so desperate to like make something hit, to make people care about AI video, that they're just spending so much to make this happen too.
And in some cases, it's part of these AI like images are part of like a larger scam. Sometimes they're actually like trying to get money from people. But in a lot of other cases, it's literally just like, here's something that looks like a photo album of Jesus hanging out with like attractive cabin crew members. I don't know what it is. I mean, yes, like Jesus is always going to be popular, or it's going to be like some white guy with long hair and like kind of a short beard that kind of sort of looks like Jesus. Cabin crew, like veterans and other military personnel who are literally wearing like fatigues and stuff. Often they're amputees. Sometimes it's like really, really graphic images of like poor people like squatting by the side of a
emaciated
road.
Emaciated people. Like it's sympathy creation, I think, is what a lot of folks are trying to do. So share around this image. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, like one of the most interesting facts from this article was that in a lot of cases, the image might be weird because the prompt is being translated from Hindi or Urdu into English, and then you're putting the English prompt into the image generator, and so it's getting the like partial translation, like not great semantic meaning from the original thing that you wanted, and you're just like putting that on Facebook. So it reminds me of that quote about how like the future is here, but it's not very well distributed. Dystopia is also here. It's just you don't always see it.
You don't always see it, but you feel the effects of it.
Especially like people living in, you know, Western countries, you see it in this like very strange kind of glancing way. Like, this is why there's so much AI crap on Facebook.
Stuff your aunts or uncles would share. You know, like this is where a lot of it comes from. So I don't know. I don't know what this is going to
I wonder if it goes as crazy on WhatsApp as it does on Facebook.
I mean, most definitely. I'd have to assume, like, yeah. Especially with older generations hearing wild images. Like, AI is producing stuff that we have never seen before, and I think it's just freaking a lot of people out, but also making it something people want to share. So, we don't know what's going to come up from this. It just seems like a thing Facebook is doing, Meta is doing to promote its AI images. I wonder if they're going to get, like, they're not technically doing anything wrong here. They're just using their money to produce this. But I wonder if somebody's going to say something about, like, is this weird? Is this inhumane? I don't know. Speaking of humane, by the way, briefly.
Excellent segue.
Briefly, we saw the story this week that people are apparently returning the humane AI pin faster than the company can sell them. Some interesting numbers here. To date, around 10,000 AI pins have been sold. To who? Who is buying these things? 3,000 have been returned. That means 7,000 are still in the hands of customers. For a $700 device, that is still, that's a lot of things out there. Apparently also over 1,000 pre-orders were canceled once the reviews started coming in, like Sherlin's great review about it being absolutely terrible. What's even more interesting here, by the way, is that the company has no way to like refurbish or recycle these things. So they just get dumped.
Oh, cool.
So they have no way to like resell them to make even like a minimal amount of payback. It's just garbage.
So is this the AI pin version of the fact that they buried all those ET NES games?
They will maybe it'll get stripped for parts. I don't know. Our future will find these things and try to build the story around why humans created them.
I'd really love to have one of these because I was saying a few episodes ago.
And they catch fire. Like, they explode.
Yeah, okay, yes, they did get very, very hot. But I was saying before that, like, oh, I was, like, really interested in that, what's the mask?
The Razer mask?
Yeah, the Razer Zephyr mask. Yes. So I was thinking about buying one of those just because it was, like, a cool cyberpunk thing. And now that Razer had to refund everyone who bought one, it would have been free. That would have been like a cool thing for my personal museum of garbage tech. And I'd love to have a humane AI pin for the personal museum of garbage tech, but it's working on central servers, so eventually it will just be an object. Like, you can't even get it to connect to anything, because
maybe the laser projector will throw an error message and you can hold your hand up. I don't know.
Yeah, I can only hope. But like, once humane does whatever it does in its end stages, it's just going to end up getting bricked, right?
Oh yeah, most definitely. It's I mean, I like buying dead old hardware just to look at the hardware. I never expect the software to like stay living. Like, I've got a couple Zune HDs around. I have some Kin phones, the Microsoft Kin phones. I still want to get a Palm Pre because I want to do the sliding and feel that keyboard. Never.
Very quick correction from Mark Dell. He says that the ET games that were buried in a landfill were Atari games, not NES games.
Atari games.
I keep on saying, chat keeps us honest. Thank you for keeping us honest.
Thank you for keeping us honest. I actually think this is a good place right now for the correction, Ben. So I will just put this in. Quick correction on something we talked about last week. Southwest Airlines is apparently running old software, but not Windows 3.1 old. That was a little bit of a shitpost, and we did not notice that that was kind of revealed not to be real at the time. And I just wasn't fully paying attention to news at that point either. But yeah, to be clear, Southwest is still running old software, though, which is why the CrowdStrike outage didn't really affect them too much. But yeah, they're not running Windows 3.1. That would be funny, though. I'd love to see it. let's move on to what we're working on. Real quick, I'm still testing some AI PC stuff. I wrote up a review for something we'll be talking about in a bit. And we're all prepping for the Google event next week as well. And we're all thinking about Apple, too. Like, yeah, the Apple stuff is coming down soon. So that's me. Okay, let's move on to pop culture picks for the week. For me, I have been all in on Industry Season 3. This is a show I've been loving forever. Industry is a show I've told Chulin to watch like years ago. Season 3 is starting on Sunday. And this is a show created by Mickey Down and Conrad Kay, who are two British screenwriters. This is their first project, actually, their first like major series. Season 1 of Industry was like their first basically big series of their own. And I really love this show. It is very much like Succession. It's about people who are mostly terrible, who are kind of amoral, making decisions that are often very selfish and behaving badly. But it's also very fascinating to see people in that, behave that way, I guess. Unlike Succession, it's also about people who are striving to be rich and striving to be powerful. And I think the thing, I love Succession so much, but that was ultimately a show about a rich family trying really hard to hold on to like their place in the world and the money that they have. And this is a show that's a little bit different because I think people are more ambitious because they're trying to get to that point. It's about an investment bank called Pierpoint that is world renowned. And we start off following a bunch of young characters. It's a lot like Skins, actually, where it's a young crew of people who become friends. They have a lot of personal dynamics or relationships between them. There's a lot of soap opera stuff, but there's also a lot of, I think, storylines around ambition and what they're all trying to achieve and how smart they are. We had a really good interview. I talked with Conrad Kay and Mickey Down, and you can listen to that at the end of this episode. But they talk about the show as something they like, is just seeing competent people being very good at their jobs. And that is something that just really hits for me. Michael Clayton is one of my favorite movies. I love everything Tony Gilroy writes. I love fixers. I love people who are smart and just like clearly very capable. And all these characters are essentially some version of that. So I think that itself is very entertaining. And also, yeah, it also explores the investment banking world and the financial world in ways that we don't really see too often. I think of movies like Margin Call or Boiler Room, maybe Wall Street. This is very technical. It's very gritty. It's very in there. And I think it's a fantastic show. It's also evolved to be really ambitious in season 3. What's his face? Jon Snow. Kit Harington from Game of Thrones joined season 3 as a startup founder. Maybe something's fishy about him. So it is really interesting to see them go full into like a bit of the tech world too. But yeah, take a listen to our interview at the end of this episode. You can hear some thoughts on that. And I also wrote up a review at the site. So check it out at Engadget.com. Also want to quickly shout out, I really enjoyed Trap, which is M. Night Shyamalan's latest movie that is super divisive, but I love a divisive movie. I love his like unreality of the way he constructs things. Nobody in that movie behaves like an actual human being, but it is a really fun thing to watch in a theater. You know, it's like, it's almost, he basically made a midnight movie unintentionally. He's like totally sincere about it, but it is as bonkers as something like The Room at times. Like, it just goes places. I had a lot of fun with it. You can check out my full review at the Filmcast podcast at thefilmcast.com. Ben, you got anything you want to shout out?
Yeah. So if you've heard some of my picks when I get to do picks in the past, mm-hmm. you'll know that I am very much a documentary guy. I work in documentaries, like doing kind of NPR sort of stuff when I'm not doing Engadget stuff. And I'm really into the films of Frederick Wiseman mm-hmm. right now. He is a documentary director who will just point a camera at stuff and let things transpire. Mm-hmm. There is no sitting people down for confessional interviews. There is kind of sort of like main characters that they will follow, but it won't really try to make a huge story out of these specific characters. It's more about the place. A lot of his movies are named for the place rather than, you know, some whiz-bang phrase someone said during the filming of the documentary. Mm-hmm. So you have these names like high school. He just went to a high school and filmed a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
I was recently watching Basic Training, which is Army basic training around the Vietnam War era. There's another film that I'm looking forward to called Missile that was released in 1988. And it was just about like the training process and the day-to-day operation of a nuclear missile silo.
I mean, not too long ago, he did Ex Libris, right? The one about the New York Public Library, which is a fantastic film. Everybody should see that. It's really good.
And he did a really great one. Actually, the reason that I went and started watching a lot of his stuff is that he released a doc late last year that was also like in theaters kind of early this year about a French restaurant, like a 3 Michelin star French restaurant, and just the day-to-day comings and goings of that. I have to warn listeners, some of these movies can be boring.
You're just watching stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So like sometimes it's like really amazing because like there's this one scene in Basic Training where a drill sergeant is talking about how he's reading this book about like reincarnation and karma and like all of that stuff. And you're like, wow, that's a really interesting point of view for a drill sergeant in that era. Like that's really cool to see. And then there are other cases like at Berkeley where he just hung out at UC Berkeley for a while, where it just feels like you're in a college class. So if you're not into watching like a 20-minute long cut of just a college class discussion, maybe skip that one or feel free to skip around, especially at Berkeley, because that one is like 3 hours long.
Skip around, but you gotta put your phone down, get in the vibe. Like these are movies where you gotta groove with them, and if you don't, it's fine. But it is I wish more people were making movies like this. Yeah. Purely
so,
observational. Yeah.
Check out the films of Frederick Wiseman. I can't recommend them to everybody, but for some people, you'll really love them.
Awesome. Good pick, Ben. Thank you so much. Well, that's it for the show this week, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman, this guy right here. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, all over. I'm on Threads, but I don't really talk to people on Threads. Sorry. Where can we find you, Ben?
You can find me at an email address. Send me an email at benelman.wave. That's benelman.wav@gmail.com.
I love the dot wave. Email us at podcast@gadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, folks, including Spotify. And stay tuned for my chat with Bicky Down and Conrad K, the showrunners of Industry. Now on to my interview with Mickey Down and Conrad K, the showrunners and creators of the TV show Industry. Mickey Down speaks first here. Mickey Down and Conrad K, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. This is a show that is so deeply entrenched in investment banking speak and financial speak. Every time I watch Industry, I wonder, how do you guys make this language both understandable to viewers and also compelling dramatically? It seems like you're dealing with harder territory than something like Succession does, you know?
That's very kind to say that it's, what you say, it was accessible.
Making it accessible, make it both accessible and dramatic, right? That is tough.
It's really hard. I won't lie. It's hard. It's got easier, I think. Look, from a personal perspective, it's got easier because I understand what the characters are saying more just by learning far more while I was most of writing the show than I had in my very short career in investment banking. And I'm interested in it, which makes me want to understand what we're writing a bit more and understand the stuff that we're exploring. It is tricky though, because like one of the main things that most people say when they talk to us is, I don't know anything about investment banking, but somehow I managed to make this feel psychologically and emotionally interesting. But I don't know. Maybe it's because at the core of it, some of the stuff we're dealing with, relationship with ambition, high stress situation, putting your job before everything else, they're somewhat universal in this and to a lot of people. So maybe people just, you know, they might not understand what a swap sheet is or what a vol swap is, but they understand the intention behind wanting to do that work.
We did. I think we did season one. It was very much techno babble, and it was very hard to follow because the business storylines were not very well serialized. We were dealing in products, which, to be honest, are almost impossible to understand for the people who trade them. So I don't understand how like a viewer was expected to come along for the ride. As the show developed, and especially season 3, we've really tried to make it a more serialized, more accessible, more of the world storyline, you know, an energy IPO, the failure of that, a government bailout. These are all things in the public consciousness, which people have a better understanding of their bowl swap. And I think part of what makes the show understandable and accessible is the naturalism of the performances, how grounded they are, the camera style, having a quite a verite subjectivity. So it takes you right into it. So moment to moment, even if you don't understand it, you're finding it incredibly engaging. It's a real testament to the actors. And in season three, we did a thing which we were afraid to do over in season one or two, which was basically have characters say exposition within the scene. Mm-hmm. And because of the quality of the acting, you could have a summary line which says, actually, this is just what happened in this scene. And because of the people we're working with, they said that. So I think season three is a far more accessible proposition than seasons one and two.
Gotcha.
I think from a personal point of view, I like jargon and technical language in TV shows.
Same. Yeah.
It makes the characters feel like they're competent. And I like watching competent people be good at their jobs. And there's a rhythm to the way that people in finance speak, which when you've been around it, is easy to figure out whether it's fake or not. And I think we're writing so that every finance bro thinks we're doing the right thing and thinks that we're authentic. I do get a sense of pride that people who are in our previous industry, finance, got it right. That's good.
Yeah, you described it as competent people doing competent things. And that is a very specific genre that I also enjoy. I think one of my favorite films is Michael Clayton and certainly anything Tony Gilroy does. I'm getting a lot of that from you guys. So just wanted to say congrats. Like, you're definitely hitting things like Boiler Room and other films around financing and banking that I think just really hit. I've read interviews with you guys from season two where you felt like you had a better sense of what the show is then compared to season one. And I think I felt that as viewer two. How do you guys think of industry now as season three? Are you treating the show any differently? Or are you taking dramatic swings differently than you did before?
More ambition, I think, was the watchword, because we know we've been doing it for 8 years now. We started off, we were very inexperienced writers, deliberately wrote about a very sealed off hermetic experience, a very universal one, which is people starting in the workplace at the same time. But the reality of the show and the authenticity meant that by its very nature, our characters couldn't have very much agency and they didn't have very much power. Mm-hmm. And the show is also about people growing up. And so basically, by its very nature, the show was set up so the characters couldn't move through corridors of power. Yeah. Now the characters are older, they look more mature. We can put bigger stakes onto them and not lose that sense of authenticity. And we never get any guarantees about how many seasons the show is going to run. We burn all our best ideas as quickly as we can. We have a roadmap for the season, but not for multiple seasons, even though we always back ourselves to write out of corners. And there's a sense that in season three, we wanted to throw as much of the wall as we could and not have any regrets about not doing stuff. So the show feels bigger. The stakes are higher. It's more interested in how the training floor intersects with the wider world, politics, newspaper, media, class. We wanted to write about all of these big themes, but never lose what was always the key tenet of what we wanted the show to be, which was a really entertaining, character-driven drama about people in a workplace.
Was there any sense of, hey, this could be HBO or Max's next succession because you guys are filling that schedule hole? And I always felt like these two shows were almost working in parallel. Like, I think Succession was a really interesting story about power dynamics, and you guys are doing that too with a much more diverse cast and younger folks too. Did you think about like how to make the show more accessible? Because I was surprised that you can't just jump into things with season three too. There's no like recap or anything.
No, like, we definitely thought about making it more accessible. Yeah. I think that was just part and parcel of making it more expansive. Mm-hmm. Like, a show in season one, as Conrad said, was hermetically sealed. Mm-hmm. It was universal, but it was very specific about entering into a very specific industry. And season two, I think, was a denser version of that. It was like dealing with quite esoteric parts of the healthcare industry and through a lens which was very, in itself, esoteric. And season three, we just like, in expanding the universe, expanding, going into a company, doing an IPO, showing how that's the mechanism of all of that. That was stuff we wanted to write about, but just by its very nature, that's stuff that people have a sense of understanding. People understand, they at least heard the term IPO. They understand what an energy company does. It provides energy to your house. The mechanics of that and how funded are interesting to us and hopefully interesting to other people. But it felt more in season three like we're actually like holding the audience's hand or we're like welcoming them in to the show and really asking them to understand what we're writing about. Whereas, as Conrad said, in season one, it was like, yes, there's lots of technical language, but like it really it was really there to show the competency of the character rather than actually pushing the story on.
Mm-hmm. I would say as an advert for the show very quickly that I can imagine if people come cold and have never heard of it, they might be put off by the fact that there are 16 episodes to watch before the third season. I know I would feel like that. I would say that season three, you could, if you wanted to tune into the pilot on its own without any of the context or the episode one of 301, I think you could enjoy season three without all of the context of seasons one and two. I think it's deepened the lore of it. You could go back and have the lore deepened by watching those two seasons, but I don't think you should be put off for watching the season for not seeing the first two.
Gotcha. It's like an impossible task. Like, how do you tell a continuous story, but also keep bringing in new viewers? So I feel for you guys. It's tough work. I was pleased to see that, a tech company, a green tech company, is more of a focus in this season. Kit Harington's character is the CEO of that. That's just a field I understand more. So that helped me get me into the show more. But is the tech industry something you guys are thinking about, too, in relation to the financial sector, too? Because even since you guys have started writing the show, big tech has had more and more of an influence on the world. I know creatives in particular right now are annoyed at a lot of big tech companies. Was there a specific reason you chose a tech company? And is that an industry you want to focus more on in the future, too?
I think it's just part of our everyday life, the way that always has been. Obviously, technology has always been part of that. But like, specifically like big tech or like tech startups, and just something that's so prevalent in the UK and the US now. When we left university, for example, like the sort of pathway to a job was usually predicated on like a milk round set of interviews and then like a job at a consultancy or a bank or a law, go to law school or something like that. But like now, like most of the people who leave good universities or any universities just looking for jobs in tech and usually in stuff. And there's been a huge brain drain away from finance for that very reason. Like the salaries are almost as good as they are in finance. Although sometimes there's more incentives, there's better work-life balance, there's participation, there's stock, there's everything that you just don't get from a finance. So we wanted to write about a few different things from a business standpoint in the season. We wanted to write about an energy company that had real-world stakes that felt like it was sort of scratching the heel of a bit of a sort of bigger non-competitors. Monopolistic competitors. And then also we wanted to write about the collapse of a company which has really been found to be really good, and how what happens when that company goes to put and leaves a lot of the structure in its wake. What does it look like if a company that has millions of people rely on for their energy goes to the wayside? And what does it look like if it has to be bailed out £2 billion? We never really cared about the real world consequences of the show before. And the stakes for the real economy and that stuff that we thought is a lot more interesting.
Gotcha. And I think speaking of tech trends, I feel like AI is the thing everyone's talking about now. I'm just wondering, is that a thing you're ever considering exploring within industry or in future seasons? And how do you guys feel about it?
So hard to write. It's hard to write. It's a bit like when we wanted to write about tech and like we wanted to write about, we thought we had to write about tech in a way that feels like a bit real world applicable. Yeah. That's where we ended up clean energy. Because we thought about apps, we thought about like online marketplaces. We just thought we needed something that felt tangible still. Yes, Lumi is a company that probably has a huge online presence and it's essentially really a sort of marketing company in the fact that like you have an app, like we're sending an app, bring your energy to you. But then behind it was this natural gas, there's natural energy that's actually being provided. So it felt like a good bridge into doing maybe a tech story in the future. Because I feel intimidated by tech in some respects and writing about it, because there's just so much better writing than I would.
Now you guys know how I feel, like just listening, getting through the financial jargon. Yeah. How do you feel personally about the rise of AI, especially among creatives? Because I know this is like a big topic right now. A lot of tech companies are pushing AI as a solution for making art quickly, helping with your writing and things like that. I have a feeling, like just from the perspective I've seen within industry, that you guys would have maybe not the most welcoming view of AI at this point.
It's a hard thing to wrap your head around the speed at which it's happening. And the obviously writing suggests a sort of soulfulness and there's a kind of human quality which you want to tell yourself is replicable by machine. But obviously the rate at which these machines learn their ability to ape things, it's naive to think that they won't be able to spit out Tony Gilroy quality script.
Right.
It's like, what is the time horizon or something like that? I think you would hope that, and I know we're generally terrible as a species at like self-government or preventative measures. We're very good reactively as a species and we're terrible proactively. Mm-hmm. So you would hope that there would be things in place so me and Mickey are not necessarily out of work, like something that can do it in a hundredth of the time at no cost. That is the kind of terrifying thought. And obviously there'll be great applications of that sort of software, but the idea of it being put out of work for the idea of being used to generate art, whatever that means, mm-hmm. and taking away the human component, taking away the time, the actual time component of application, the sort of weird alchemy that goes into making something, which is totally inexplicable, like on some very fundamental level. The idea to try to recreate that in the aggregate with a machine is, I think, dystopian and horrible.
Yeah,
that's also a very negative way of looking at something that potentially has incredible applications. Mm-hmm. So obviously, there's both sides of it.
I think within the world of industry that we've seen so far, I could just see some character taking the very cynical view of AI as like, hey, this thing can create art. Let's bank on this. Doesn't matter if it means anything, right? The meaning doesn't matter. It's the money you can make off of it. And at least from my perspective in the tech world, that's what I'm seeing. So I don't know. I feel like it'd be a good handshake there at some point. Mm-hmm. Can you guys talk about you said you were considering different tech angles going into the season. What sort of research did you do thinking and writing about the tech industry?
Like, it was that we have an amazing consultant mm-hmm. who we have two amazing consultants, but our major consultant is this sort of ex sell side turned buy side guy who works in hedge funds mm-hmm. who he has a macro view on everything, on every single sector. So in season two, he was the one that really pushed the idea of working in healthcare, and he found all this sort of esoteric ways into that.
Yeah.
In season three, we really wanted, beyond writing about tech, we wanted to write about ethical investing and ESG. Mm-hmm. And actually, if there was a contradiction in terms of ethical investing and the tension between those two things, and whether actually you are, is there a space to be altruistic in investing? And it was that really was the bedrock of the season from a business point of view rather than writing about tech.
Yeah.
But as I said, I'm incredibly intent. I'm trying to think of really good pictures of tech.
I think the show Silicon Valley on HBO honestly did a good job while also being in comedy.
Yeah, that does it brilliantly. That was a show which had a lot of technical language, yep. which was easy to understand in some respects. Like other times, I found myself trying to Google stuff, but like I liked it because it felt like it was written from a place of authenticity and ran by people who actually inhabited that world, which mm-hmm. is what right to do industry. And like, it's hilarious as well, which goes without saying, but like, I did think that it was like incredibly smart as well. And like, these things, they're a bit like finance, like these things are ripe for caricature. Mm-hmm. And yes, there was caricatures in Silicon Valley, but it was always from a place of reality and like from a place of like real insight into what Silicon Valley is. Like an easy version of a finance show, just like a guy in like bracing and trumping a cigar, being pushing it through everyone and making loads of money. That would probably be quite fun to watch as well. But I think where industry, I know the beauty of industry in some ways is that it was written by people who had some kind of like first-hand experience of it, which allowed us to write and replace authenticity.
Gotcha. All right. I have a ton of questions for you guys, but my time's running out. So I just want to say thank you so much. Congrats on the season. Hoping to see more from you guys eventually. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one, guys. Bye.
Thanks.